I will call the Subcommittee on Employee Relations to order. We do have a quorum. We have Senator Wergen taking another job. There's 9 members, and we have 5 here, which constitutes a quorum. So, first item on the agenda is to approve the minutes of last meeting. And
I'll make that motion, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bingham moves to approval of the minutes. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. I believe the next item is to review and approve the arbitration award and collective bargaining agreement with the Minnesota Nurses Association. I believe this is the last one we have. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members, that's correct.
So, Mr. Larson, did you wish to address the committee? And this took a little different route here. Is that correct? Went through arbitration, I see. And why don't you state your name and brief the commission on what happened.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Paul Larson. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Finance and Employee Relations, and also in that capacity I serve as the state labor negotiator. We have before you the final labor agreement for the state units that are under the umbrella of the Department of Finance and Employee Relations, and I do believe this is all of the units in the executive branch. The Minnesota Nurses Association represents this unit. It's bargaining unit number 5 under the Public Employee Labor Relations Act. There are approximately 750 nurses, registered nurses, that are assigned to this unit. These are non-supervisory registered nurses in our state system. The large agencies predominantly occupying these nurses are the Department of Human Services, the Department of Corrections, the Department of Veterans Affairs, and also the Health Department. We do have nurses in some of the other departments, but predominantly those are the large agencies that employ the nurses. This nurse is designated as an essential unit. In other words, they cannot strike, and therefore they have the right to go to interest arbitration in resolving their contract negotiations, which the Nurses Association, in fact, elected this time to do. So we reached impasse late last fall. We presented the arguments to the arbitrator this spring. The briefs were due normally 30 days after that, and we received the decision about 35 days ago, and in accordance to 3.855, we submitted the arbitrator's decision to the executive director of the subcommittee, and therefore we're here before you today to bring that for your approval. We're generally pleased with the arbitrator's decision. The arbitrator awarded the state's position on the employer's wage package, which was consistent with our other negotiated agreements. That was a 3.25% across the board, both years, for all employees in this class. It's retro to July of 07. there will be a retro check for the nurses in this unit. In addition to that, Mr. Chair, what we also had was a series of what we considered to be advanced practice class nurses that we felt we had some issues with regard to our desires from a compensation point of view, and so we added a new step to the 5 job classifications that are what we consider to be advanced practice nurses. That will be effective in August of this year. There were also some, what I would call, some fairly protracted issues in regard to nurse overtime. We were unable to reach an agreement at the bargaining table. However, the arbitrator, I believe, crafted in response to the positions of the parties, something that the employer can work with. I'm sure that'll be back at the bargaining table next time with the Nurses Association. It has also, the nurses have a employee contribution to a health care savings account, which they contribute $75 a month to the health care savings account that's administered by the Minnesota State Retirement System. They've increased that employee contribution to $100 a month. In addition to that, we also increased the shift differential by 5 cents, and that's also consistent with our other nurses. The about 50% of the nurse unit is at the top of the pay scale. They are not eligible for step increases. Generally speaking, we think that this award falls in our conforms with how we've treated our other state units, which is very important to us. Cost of the contract is the new money is about $10 million in new money. This has a biennial base currently of $113 million, so we're going to be adding an additional $10 million onto this unit. The biennial costs are to operate this unit for the 07-09 round is 8.73%, and then what we're in effect referred to as tails, or what is this going to be, what is the base increase going to be on June 30th of 09 as opposed to June 30th of 07, that is an increase of 14.32%. So we are here before you to answer any questions that the committee may have, and I believe that covers my report.
Mr. Larson, one of my big concerns is the language on overtime for the nurses. What did we do? Maybe you said it and I wasn't listening, but that was a big consideration for me anyway.
Well, the challenges that the employer has with overtime, and we did testify against the legislation, and we elected not to continue testifying against the legislation based on some of the testimony that occurred in the hearing. The concern that we have with the nurse overtime, and that is that typically in our correctional facilities, our veterans' homes, and DHS facilities, we are always operating with minimal staffing. And we have vacation requests, we have sick leave requests, we have a variety of leaves that are available to our employees. And so it's not uncommon that we don't have an extra staff person, so to speak. For example, on the midnight shift in one of our facilities, we may only have two nurses in our correctional facility, or one nurse, and so on. And the question is what happens if someone calls in sick? And we don't have anybody, and that was our huge issue. We obviously are concerned about patient safety, and that was the thrust of the association, was that if a nurse feels compelled that they're not able to provide adequate care for their patients, and they do indicate that, we can't discipline a nurse for refusing to work overtime, and we don't discipline nurses for refusing to work overtime, unlike some of the positions that have been made. But when you run a 24/7 facility, whether it's a correctional facility or the veterans' homes and so on, we do have situations where we simply don't have anyone, and we do have to force people to work overtime. And it's just something that people have been prepared for in the occupation that they've chosen. We are concerned about what we're going to do in some of those facilities when this happens, and we're contracting out work now, and we're meeting with the agencies to try to get this matter resolved, and if we can't get it resolved, we'll bring it back to the legislature for their input and thoughts on how we can work this out.
Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the problem with the staffing? I mean, there is a high turnaround. Can you explain why we are having problems with the staffing levels? Is it wages? Is it benefits? Is it It's kind of an open-ended question, but...
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Bigham, I can give you a variety of answers, but this collective bargaining agreement, similar to our other state agreements, has over 40 different leave provisions in there, 40. And that at any given time, we very seldom have more staff on than what we need, and it's the unanticipated call-in for which we just didn't have a plan in place. So then the balancing act on this is that let's say, for example, you have two staff that are designated for the midnight shift, and you have three and a half FTEs or full-time equivalents assigned to that shift, for example. On any given day, someone's gone, whether it's alternate holiday or holiday pay, sick leave, vacation, and so on. So we're always running at that minimum staffing pattern, and if we will always have that issue, and that's what is driving this. The others are not.
Representative Bigham.
Thank you. One follow-up. I'm going to just say for the last 8 years, has the turnaround rate increased or decreased?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bigham, we did an analysis on the turnover rate for this unit. One of the things when you look at turnover rate is, did they leave because of pay? And I think that's what we really try to look at. We think if someone retires, there's nothing that attributes to our pay there. We think if, unfortunately, they pass away, there's nothing that's attributed to our turnover rate there. When people take jobs in different agencies, we don't think that that's attributable to our turnover rate as well. We have somewhat anecdotal information. A lot of agencies don't do exit interviews. But we, in preparation for this case, what we did was we really drilled down to find out what the turnover rate was. For example, if someone leaves because their spouse is moving to a different part of the country and so on. Our turnover rate for this unit was about, if I recall in that hearing, was about 8%. Any employer that has a 10% turnover rate or less is something that we should be able to manage. We're, I think, in the market in the area of pay, and I also think it's important that we recognize the uniqueness of the nurses, and I think that in this case here in the last round of bargaining, the nurses received the largest settlement of any of our DUER bargained units, and I can assure you that this round of bargaining, even though the interest arbitration, this is the largest settlement than any of our other units either.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Larson, I'd just like an answer of increased or decreased. Has the turnover rate increased over the last 8 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bigham, I don't think I'd have the answer for the 8 years, but I know in the last couple of years it's decreased.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to make a comment that I think that this is a unique bargaining unit, and as far as they're in charge of taking care of you know, the veterans and a lot of the other things. So I just think that, one, I would like the answer to over the last, I just want more than the last year or two. I would like to know a little bit longer period than that, whether turnover rate has increased or decreased. But I'm not going to disagree with you that this is a unique bargaining unit that we should take some serious consideration over because of the care that, you know, they have to do, and if they're getting short-staffed and getting burnt out, there is a turnover rate on it. This is people's health that's on the line here, and lives are on the line here. So,
Representative Bigham, you're right on when you talk about who they're dealing with. They're dealing with sex offenders, they're dealing with criminally insane, mental illness issues, and all nursing people are challenged, but I would guess that this group is overly challenged, if that's a word or phrase, but because they are dealing with pretty tough folks out there. But Senator Betzel.
Well, Mr. Chair, on that point, from the summary that we have, it looks like the Nurse Association, you know, made the argument that they should have higher pay because of the patients they care for are dangerous. I don't know if the arbitrator actually got into that issue as a point of determination, or did, you know, that was an issue raised by the nurses, but did the arbitrator go back and address that particular point on the type of patients that they are dealing with?
Mr. Larson, what happened at that arbitration, though?
Senator Betzel's question. Mr. Chair, Senator Betzel, there was discussion to that extent. There was a lot of discussion primarily in the area, should we be paid the same as our acute care hospitals in the metropolitan area? And I think that was more where the focus was. The employer argued that we think that our nursing population is not in a comparison with the Twin City acute care hospitals. I would also, I think it's important to share with you that while we do have a challenging population, and I've been in those correctional facilities, and I've been in St. Peter, and I've been in Moose Lake, and I've been in our DHS facilities, and I think the state has done an outstanding job in minimizing the risks that are associated with our clientele and our population. And while I understand the concern of that, I also believe that as an employer, our facilities have state-of-the-art equipment, geographics, physics, and so on that we have that are available there. And I would encourage you anytime to take a tour of one of those facilities. I think they're great places for our employees to work in minimizing the safety and security.
Well,
Mr. Chair, I'm actually quite familiar with those facilities, and I represent clients in them. But my question was, did the arbitrator actually get down to offering any conclusions on that particular issue, whether we should look at raising the pay because of the dangerousness? I know what the state's position is. I would know what the nurses. I just can't see if the arbitrator weighed in on the particular issue or not.
Mr. Chair, Senator Betzel, no, I do not believe. I think there was more thrust from the association on the salary schedule of the Twin City acute care hospitals.
Okay, thank you.
But you gotta, I would think you compare apples to apples in this area, but it doesn't sound like the arbitrator. And there's a big demand out there for nurses nowadays, and but I hear you say that the pay is kind of comparable in the private sector to the public sector?
Well, Mr. Chair, what I would say from a pay point of view is that there are a lot of components that you look at when we look at that. First of all, when you look at what I would say 50% of the population of this unit is at the health department, so they're public health nurses, okay? We do look at what Hennepin County pays, what Ramsey County pays, and so on. The other, what you look at is what our nursing homes paying, what our other clinics paying. And we do feel that we are in the market in that area. And so, and I also think it's important to share is that we have an internal compensation system with regard to other job classes, and that's also important that we look at as well. So I believe that from an employer's point of view, we look at all those. And when you look at the Twin City hospitals, for example, they're only paid by how many hours they actually work, how many compensated the hours that they have. Their staffing is based on patient acuity. How many patients do they have? We don't have that in our contract. You can have a part-time nurse that after 8 years they're at the top of the salary scale. If they're part-time, they're working in the Twin City Hospital, they're only going to move in the salary range based on compensated hours. So there are a lot of components when you look at compensation.
Okay. Well, we're going to hear from the Nurses Association just for a minute and probably clear it up in my mind anyway about some of these salary stuff and if there's any discrepancies there, you know. But,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lenny.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. just like a clarification, Mr. Larson, on the biennial base number, the $113 million, that's the base for the current biennium that's in the budget. Is that correct?
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, what that $113 million is that for starting July 1 of 07 until June 30th of 09, which we just passed, the wages that we paid, the steps that we paid, the on-call pay, the overtime, all of those costs that associated with running that unit, that's what it costs, $113 million.
Mr. Chairman, so this is the number that's in the current biennial budget, and if that is the case, what was it the previous biennium, comparable number?
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, the $113 million base is the base that ended on June 30th of 07, and so we're actually into this, the new biennium. It's just taken this long to get this contract here. So if you take that $130 million, you need to add the additional $10 million to that for the current biennium that we're in. I'd say that just judging, not having the 05-07 biennial costs, I would say that judging from my recollection that this unit was probably in, probably about $90 million at that time. It increases about $10 million dollars over each biennium.
So the base, Mr. Chairman, the base for the previous biennium, 06-07, would have been $15 million or so below this $113 million. Is that I'm just trying to get a sense here.
I understand.
What I'm trying to do is to get a handle on what increase in cost was there from 06-07 to 08-09, and then I take it what you're saying is that the if this is approved, we will have a 14.23 increase in the base from this current biennium to what we start with in the next biennium. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Representative Lanning, that is correct. What you have is, first of all, is that 06-07, it's really 05-07. Our biennial, our labor contracts are consistent with the biennial budget. And so when we start out the bargaining process, what we do is we analyze what our labor costs were for that 24-month period of time, then what the wage increase is going to, what it costs us, and that therefore creates the first set of numbers, how much money are we actually spending, and that's that 8.73% to run it. And then the next number, which is the 14.32, is, I believe, the number that you're questioning, which is what is this setting the stage for the next biennium? And it's increasing it by 14.32%. It's high, and I think that that's attributable to those advanced practice classes that we've increased the range to.
Thank you. Yeah, which was probably long overdue, in my opinion. But so that's what kind of gets it up there a little bit, is the ranges were changed. I think that's the question or the answer to Senator Scheib.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize that I came in a little late. Was there any discussion about whether or not we've had some kind of a study, or the department has, or and maybe the nurses representatives here will share that with us?
I don't know that.
It's about time to do that, to compare apples to apples, as you're saying, because it seems to me that there's a big difference if you are a public health nurse and you're in an office. I mean, I don't know all the responsibilities of a public health nurse, but let's say it's in an office and people come to you and you set up appointments, et cetera. There's a big difference there between working on in a mental health wing or whatever area of the veterans home, for example, or maybe a wing where people have a variety of dementia. I guess I would ask Mr. Larson, if I may.
That's a good question.
If there's a differential, you know, you talked about that our nurses are more like nursing homes or clinical settings, which I assume means like a doctor's office kind of thing. I'm not sure what that means exactly, but do those nurses who have, you know, 10 years of experience doing that, are they earning the same as someone with 10 years experience at the vet's home with mentally ill people or dementia?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, we are continuously looking at all of our state job classifications and how we look in relationship to external comparisons. But I think it's important to know that in 43A, when we look at setting compensation, there's five criteria, and four of them are internal, and only one is external. And so our emphasis is on how do we rank internally. But we do. We've commissioned a study a few years ago on how we ranked in relationship with our external comparison. It becomes a challenge because in a lot of instances, private sector employers are reluctant to give compensation information out because it's typically used against them. That is a challenge for us. And what we try to do is look at the appropriate job match, and what we look for. And in the last study that we did, when we looked at we hired a consultant to do, which cost about $15,000, the information that we received is that our job matches matched with some of the private sectors who were willing to provide us that information, that we were well within our bounds on the area of compensation. I also think it's important to know that no one can touch us on insurance. Our insurance package is phenomenal. And what you're finding in a lot of the other public sector and private sector labor agreements, it's not uncommon that family coverage is costing anywhere from $300 to $400 to $500 a month for family coverage, and I think we're at about $120 a month. That's good take-home money right there. I also believe that our plan design and everything is can't touch it. And one of the things when we discuss this with labor is that we don't seem to be able to get enough credit for that, and I'm always there to remind them that our insurance is untouchable when we look at other employers.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, and I hope I didn't miss your answering it, but our... And I don't know if there's a right or wrong way to look at this, but do people who have the same year experience in that bargaining unit, do they, regardless of what their assignment is, are their wages the same? Is the collective bargaining unit kind of across the board in terms of experience? Or does assignment play into it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, this job, this bargaining unit has about probably, without pulling all the information, it's probably got maybe 10 to 12 job classifications, okay? The predominant job classification is the job class that we call registered nurse, okay? Mm-hmm. Then we have registered nurse senior, which is an advanced job classification. Then after that, we have a variety of what I would call advanced class nurses, such as registered nurse practitioner, registered nurse principal, and so on. And then the health department has a series of public health job classifications that they use as well. Each one of those job classifications are assigned a salary range. And so, typically, in answer to your question, a registered nurse at... Stillwater Correctional Facility is in the same salary range as a registered nurse at the Minneapolis Vets Home, because it's the same job class. But we might have a registered nurse principal, for example, which is a very high paid job class for those nurses, and they're used throughout various state agencies, but not as predominant as the registered nurse class.
Okay. Without objection, we'll hear a little bit from the Nurses Association, and quite frankly, we're going to ratify this agreement, I'm sure, this morning, but as you know, that doesn't mean we don't hear from Nurses Association. Sure. Identify yourself. And,
good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Philip Finkelstein, and I'm labor counsel for the Minnesota Nurses Association. We have over 20,000 members covered in approximately 70 labor agreements across the state. We represent close to 50% of all registered nurses who are employed in the state of Minnesota. Just to start off, certainly if the state requests, doer requests, we are more than happy to set share our wage and salary benefit information. Frankly, we set the standard for what nurses receive in pay and benefits in the state. And we set the wage rate in the Twin Cities and Duluth and around the state at regional centers. We'd be happy also to certainly engage in a win-win type of situation with the state in studying the nurse shortage at the state, the nurse turnover issue at the state, and their wages and benefits. Frankly, we're here today in support of you confirming this award. To be honest, we didn't get everything we wanted. The state didn't get everything they wanted. They taught me in law school this is called a compromise, which was what it was awarded by the arbitrator. In regards to wages, though, I do have a couple of comments off the cuff I would like to note. Number one, you're quite right. There is a nursing shortage. It is continuing. We estimate, according to our pension plan in the Twin Cities that covers approximately 10,000 nurses, that we're going to have well over half that are eligible for retirement in the next 10 years. There's increased competition. The VA hospital is opening up a huge new wing thanks to Iraq, where they're going to be hiring close to 100 new nurses for that alone. Frankly, the state wages and benefits are far behind and are falling further. This is no fault on the part of the Department of Employee Relations. They've been doing an excellent job trying to set wages and benefits when, frankly, the state's been operating on fumes for the last few years, and certainly you people know this far better than we do. But for example, somebody switching from the state of Minnesota vet's home going to work in a hospital can easily get a raise of $10,000 to $15,000 a year. In regards to the issue of benefits, I would note that people in Twin City contracts, and we have almost 10,000 nurses covered at Methodist, at Abbott, at United, at Mercy, at Unity, at Hennepin County Medical Center, St. Joseph's, St. John's, Children's, we represent them all. Their benefits start at 0.4. So in other words, they work two shifts a week, and they're getting 100% single family insurance. And they're also covered under the fine M&A pension plan. There is a concern about vacancy rates and turnover at the state. I do believe that is due to wages, which isn't the state's fault. The money just has not been there. But it's also due to such things as forced mandation of overtime. That's why we're pleased that the arbitrator finally took account of it and is dealing with it. For our other nurses across the state, they've been covered under Minnesota Statute 181.275. And as you know, you passed that in approximately 6.5 years ago, if I gave the right answer my lobbyist wanted. And certainly they've been able to work with nurses calling in sick, going on vacation, and dealing with other issues. Simply put, you don't want to force a nurse to work against her or his will if they're working over 16 hours several days in a row. At the state, they're working with the sickest of the sick. They're taking care of our veterans. They're taking care of the insane. They're taking care of people in the prisons. And although maybe in the old days, working in a psych ward wasn't seen as the toughest job, now that is the new emergency room. It's scary, scary to work there. And we want to make it better. I did write some notes. Let's see. Frankly, all things being considered, I didn't come here to discuss all of these issues, but we would urge you to study it. We would urge you that we would be more than happy to work with people like Paul Larson and other people at Doer to try and create this issue, because the vacancy problem is only going to be getting worse. If you look over not just the last year or two when we've had an economic slowdown, but when you compare it against 10 years ago, I believe at one point the vacant rate showed that we had the second or third highest vacancy rate and turnover rate of anyone in state service. But frankly, I didn't check those figures for today. That would be something a study could show. But all things getting to the base point, all things being considered, we do support the approval of this project to get it done, this contract, so the parties can get it done and move on. Thank you.
That's good. Yeah, that's a good summary.
Mr. Finkelstein, we're running out of fumes.
Okay.
Okay, any further questions, I guess? Do we have a prepared motion here? Senator Scheid?
I'd move that.
But SER1, Senator Scheid?
SER1.
Okay, you've all got it. So Representative Lilly, did you have a...
Okay. It's fine. We've kind of moved fast, Mr. Chair.
We don't want to move too fast. We're just...
I'll just ask real quickly, and one of the things that, Mr. Chair, and I heard the word minimum staffing quite a bit, and that word concerns me, because I think that's part of the reason that we have a lot of turnover probably as well, and maybe a lot of staff that end up getting injured or whatnot. I work out at the airport and for a major company that tends to have work people a little thin. And it creates an environment where people, step up and do the job. But at some point, there's a lot of wear and tear on folks. So it's not just the mandatory overtime, but also the minimum staffing. I think that word really concerns me. So hopefully in the future we can deal with that issue as well. Good. So thank you.
Good point. Any further comments or questions? Seeing none, Senator Scheid renews her motion to adopt SCR1. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you very much, folks. Let's see, we're moving on to review and approve the Office of Legislative Auditor Commission compensation plan. Mr. Nobles, hopefully we're making some headway in this area, and some of us around here believe that we have to pay people and pay them properly for the jobs that they do, and even if we're running on fumes, we have to pay and compensate our people. And tried to be an advocate, in the Senate for paying our people, and that I think we've been looking at your situation, and I believe that's why we're back here today. Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chairman and members of the subcommittee, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and I want to start by thanking you, Mr. Chairman, for your help on this issue, and Representative Bigham as well. You achieved for us a change in the law, and that's what brings us here today. You changed the law so that the legislative auditor is now responsible for creating a compensation plan for the classified employees in our office. For those of you who need a little bit of a quick refresher, the Office of the Legislative Auditor is a bit of an odd duck, if we could call it that, in terms of our personnel.
Bubbles, you're not an odd duck, though. I've worked
on certain days, Mr. Chairman, it may be. But we are because, in terms of our personnel situation, we are obviously a legislative branch office. But when the office was created in the legislative branch, many of the employees were brought over from the executive branch and kept in the classified civil service system. And I think there was good reason for that at the time. And it has worked reasonably well. But there have been issues and problems. And to try to solve those, we ask the legislature to give us more flexibility in setting the compensation, moving our people from one position to another. We really want our office to be a very performance-based organization. And sometimes the classified civil service system doesn't give us the flexibility that we need to achieve that. So you gave us that authority, and we are here with our first compensation plan. And I think it's a rather modest step because we basically keep the existing ranges that are established within the classified civil service system. We're not asking for big salary increases here or even increases really in the salary ranges at this point. The only change in salary range would be to move our managers of our evaluations into the same job range, salary range, as the financial audit managers. That's something that just sort of got out of sync some years ago. Many of you know the people who manage these big, complicated, and very visible evaluations. Our recent evaluation, for example, of Job Z would be one of these people, John Yunker, or the liquor control one that Senator Scheid is very familiar with. The evaluation that we did recently of highways and bridges. And so it's those people that we simply want to move into the same salary range as the people who manage our financial audits. No salary increase comes with this automatically. It simply moves them into a comparable range. So that's the only real impact on salaries that we're proposing in terms of salary ranges. We also want to tie any cost of living adjustment to whatever the legislature establishes, the Legislative Coordinating Commission establishes for employees covered in the legislative plan. We do ask for the flexibility to create a 4% of total salary base for giving performance increases. Again, that's a very important thing that we want to achieve, and we've struggled to do that within the classified civil service system with some help from Doar, and particularly from former Commissioner Anderson when she was here, and former state auditor. I think she was very sympathetic to our challenges and situation and was very helpful. So we would have, I think, a comparable performance increase opportunity as other legislative employees and other state employees. We would also like authority, as is laid out in the plan, to offer a lump sum award of up to $1,000 for people who achieve their CPA or other comparable national certifications. We often hire people in our financial audit division right out of college. They don't yet have their CPA, and we strongly encourage them to obtain it and other professional certifications, and it's a rather modest award that we can offer to them. And another provision would be to allow us to place new employees in the salary, in the position and salary range that we think is comparable to their qualifications, and also reclassify current employees to a position and salary that we believe is appropriate to their performance. And I might say, Mr. Chairman, that would not always just be a promotion. Again, we are a performance-based organization, and we would like the opportunity to have a change in position reflect good performance or less than satisfactory. So we ask for that discretion as well. Just to be clear, all other aspects of the commissioner and managerial plans which these employees are covered by would stay in effect. Again, this is a fairly modest step. It keeps us with these employees in the classified civil service, in the executive branch, but as a legislative office and an office that reviews the executive branch, we think we need a little more flexibility than we currently have to maintain our independence. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I again thank you, Mr. Chairman, and other members of this committee and the staff who've been very helpful in getting this put together.
Well, I, for one, think it's about time that what is happening quite a bit in state government, I think, is that we're the training ground for a lot of private sector businesses out there. Whether it be in your department, the auditors, or I was thinking of the State Board of Investment, where these people get going and they're doing a good job, and all of a sudden they're swept away by, you know, big Fortune 500 companies, and I think that's wrong. So hopefully this is a step in the right direction. Any comments by Representative Bigham?
I was just wondering, and I'm not going to use the acronym of the new Department of Employee Relations because it would make everybody chuckle. But have you spoke to them or got their feedback on your proposal here? Just out of curiosity,
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bigham, we have over the years talked to them a good deal about our situation and requested on a number of occasions greater flexibility. As I said, former Commissioner Anderson was very helpful. Other officials in the department have. Our problem has really come more when we get into the what I might call the more bureaucratic controls that we think impede on our independence. So, frankly, to answer your question, since this is an attempt to take a step away from that department, I was more interested in consulting with this subcommittee on what it considered appropriate, since, again, we are a legislative organization, and the intent here is to remove us some from the department. I have not gotten any direct feedback from them on what we've proposed here. I would assume that they don't particularly like it because it lessens their amount of control over us. That's what we intend.
Okay.
Representative Bigger? Okay. I'm not going to say it. Any more questions from the ad doc or for the ad doc? No, I won't say it. We have a resolution that Representative Lilly wants to move. That's the SCR 2. Discussion on that? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we've got number 4 is the update by Dufour on the proposed pilot CEGIP program. I know I know that Majority Leader Pogemiller's got a memo or a letter out in front of us, some concerns, but we'll either probably talk about that later and or wait for a response on that letter from the Majority Leader. But welcome. Is it Nathan Ruckel?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Yeah, welcome to the committee, and tell us what we're doing here.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Nathan Ruckel. I'm the director of the Employee Insurance Division for the newly formed Department of Finance and Employee Relations, soon to be renamed. I'm here to talk about, I believe, the announcement that the governor made related to some health care reform initiatives that the State Employee Group Insurance Program will be rolling out, some in the near future and some within 2009. Primarily, the pilot programs that we're looking at, there's essentially three programs involved. The first would be the $250 health reimbursement arrangement, or HRA. The second would be a personal health record initiative, or I'll refer to that as a PHR. And the third would be a debit card that would incorporate both the HSA component that we will be rolling out, as well as coordinating a benefit that currently exists through our flexible spending accounts. So with that, I'll just cover briefly what each one of these is intended to provide, and then I will be happy to answer any questions you may have. First we'll start with the health reimbursement account. This program really initiated from some analysis that the program did. We felt that as we had done in the past, where we had done some form of adjustment to the reserves within the program, that we wanted to make an adjustment again, and that's really where the idea of the $250 health reimbursement arrangement originated from. On a continual basis, typically every quarter, the program does review the reserves. Where's the program at? Is it funded properly? And essentially, we have what we call contingency reserve. The contingency reserve is a percentage or is money that's held in the program, and it's a relative percentage to the overall cost expectation that we have for the program in the future. Our ideal contingency reserve is 16.7% of expected expenses in the upcoming plan year. So what we do is we look to see where's the program based on where we think it's going to be going. And, of course, there is some science and some art to this. We have actuaries that we use with Deloitte Consulting that help, and we also use our plan administrators that help us calculate where is our program going, what do we think medical trend is going to look like over the next year, and how does that compare overall to the health of the program and the CEGIP reserve. And so when we feel that we are at our 16.7 or above, then we talk about are there any adjustments that need to be made. If we're below that 16.7, we would also have that same analysis. Do we need to look at increasing premiums for the upcoming year? And so what we did is we realized that that we were above the 16.7, and we wanted to make an adjustment. And so there's really two things that occurred as a result of wanting to do that. The first was the $250 HRA. That really is intending to give some of the money back to the employees in the same manner in which the reserves were increased. So this really gives back to some of the members, some of their copay increases that they may have incurred, some co-insurance costs that may have gone up as a result of the increased costs to them through their out-of-pocket costs. The second thing that we did is we looked at what were our needs for the upcoming 2009 plan year. And so what we did there is adjust the expectation on premium, which was originally set during bargaining at 10.4%. We moved that down to 3.5%. And that really did a couple things. One is that it provided some additional relief, again, in the same manner in which the reserves were funded. So we get money primarily from two sources. One is the out-of-pocket expenses that members all incur, and again, that's where the $250 comes from. And the second source of revenue is the premium itself. And so the premiums come into our program roughly on a 91-9% ratio, meaning 91% of our premiums come from state agencies, 9% of the premium comes from employees. And so by reducing the premium down to the 3.5% in 2009, we are in essence sort of giving back or providing some savings in that same ratio, that 91-9% ratio. So that by decreasing that amount, that means that employees' percentage that's needed will be reduced and the agency premium will be reduced. So, again, really trying to create both a short-term and a long-term strategy in terms of how we bring our contingency reserve more in line with that optimal 16.7%. And doing it in a mechanism and in a manner which is consistent with the way those dollars were brought into the program. On the second piece, as it relates to the personal health record, personal health records have been really on the forefront of the medical reform initiatives that have been occurring not only here within the state but nationally. And really the premise here is that as healthcare costs continue to increase and people are looking for better ways to manage these increases, that really one of the critical components that has been left out historically is that the patient really in the center of healthcare delivery really has been left out, and that a lot of the decision making really happens at the doctor level, at the pharmacy level, but the patient is sort of left out in terms of really understanding what's going on with their healthcare, how to become a better and more engaged consumer within the medical marketplace. And really the primary issue has been that there really has been a lack of access to the data as it relates to their health. We've had these discussions around health assessments in the past, but this is really more than just health assessments. This is really about what's going on with this person today. What do we know about them? What is coming through in terms of claims data? What's coming in terms of pharmaceutical data? What is in your chart? I mean, I would ask any of you if you have even seen your chart. What is the doctor putting in there? What kind of diagnoses are on your record? What could you do with that information? So as we ask members to become more and more engaged in their health care, they really need their own information really as a starting point in order to start down that path. And that really is the premise for the personal health record. So what we intend to do is, in conjunction with the unions, is to seek proposals in the marketplace, what's out there, what kinds of PHR services could be delivered to our members that would help them become more engaged consumers. We're going to look at things such as functionality. What do we want the PHR to do? Do we want it to interact with the provider? Do we want it to interact with the health plan? We'll certainly address issues like privacy and security. Our intent would be to make this sort of an opt-in model so that anybody who wants this information would have access to it, but none of the information would travel at all until a member of the Advantage program signs off that they are willing to let their information travel around the medical infrastructure so that we have the ability to share information with your doctor, with your pharmacist, with your plan administrator, with your children, with your parents, whoever it is that you want to share this information, and also allow certain information to flow around while at the same time prevent other information perhaps from traveling through this system. So as an example, if you wanted to allow all the conditions as it relates to your heart, if you're having cardiac issues, let that information flow around. But if you have other concerns, such as mental health, that you would prefer not to have be shared, then you would also then have mechanisms in place that would allow you to make those determinations. We would also want the members to have some flexibility about what actually does move around within this marketplace, so that if you want to make adjustments to your record, we want to give you the ability to do that. And we would certainly note within the system which records are coming from what sources and which records are being modified by the member, so that a doctor or, let's say, an emergency room physician is getting this information. They know the source of the information, and so that they can take that into consideration. If a member should happen to modify a particular drug or the amount taken of a drug, a physician would want to know that was maybe not coming directly from a medical provider, but was either self-populated or adjusted by a member. So there's a lot of details behind the PHR, and I won't go, I'd be certainly happy to answer any more questions you have, but that's essentially the premise of the PHR. Our goal would be to launch something for 2009. It would be ideal, I think, to do something by July 1st of 2009, but really depending on what the marketplace can deliver and how that interacts with what we really want in terms of basic functionality will really, I think, determine the ultimate launch date for a product like this. Lastly would be the debit card, and I think this is probably the most straightforward of the initiatives. Essentially, what we'd like to do is give every member within the CGIT program access to a debit card that would control both of their HRA account, the $250 that we're proposing to offer, as well as their existing flexible spending account. This would be the medical dental expense account that you all have access to, and all of our members have the ability to elect up to $5,000 in a medical dental expense account. One of the criticisms that we hear is that it's cumbersome. You have to incur the expenses up front, and then you have to provide the subsequent documentation on the back end. So first of all, it's money out of your pocket before you can get reimbursed. Sometimes the paperwork can be cumbersome. Sometimes people forget. And in the end, it's a use it or lose it program. And so if people just don't follow through, then these are really dollars that are being defaulted, and that's something that, as a program, we don't want to see. So our hope would be is that the debit card would really allow about 80% instant adjudication of all claims for both of these accounts, so that if you are at a facility, whether it's a doctor's office and you need to make a $20 copay, or you're at Target or Walmart and you're buying prescription drugs, or you're buying over-the-counter medications, or any other expense that would qualify under these programs, that you could simply swipe this debit card, it would be adjudicated instantaneously, and you wouldn't have to incur any expenses up front, and there's no follow-up paperwork on the back end. And this card would coordinate the two benefits in such a way that the FSA dollars would be accessed first, because they are use it or lose it dollars. And once that account is exhausted, or if the member doesn't set up an account, we would then turn to the $250 HRA account. But we would really want to tap that as a secondary source, because the HRA is you can roll it over from year to year. So again, the intent of the debit card is to make it easy, to make it convenient, and this is really a savings both for the employees and for the state. Employees obviously don't pay taxes on all their pre-tax contributions, and the state doesn't pay FICA on those earnings. And so it really is kind of a win-win. And we're hopeful that people will see the convenience of this debit card and just increase the amounts of their flexible spending accounts, because again it's a great tax benefit for the members. But yet we have less than a quarter of our members actually enrolling in flexible spending accounts today, and we'd like to see that number increase. So with that, that sort of sums up, I think, the initiative that we have in front of us, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Morocco, I'm not. I want to understand the process a little bit more. Not necessarily picking on the initiatives, but I mean, you've got and who approves this? You've got Senator Betzel, who chairs a major appropriations committee. As far as I know, he first learned about this stuff today. And you've got his counterpart in the House that. So is this kind of the process where the executive branch comes in and says, here's what we're going to do, and we're expected to follow suit, or is it more appropriate to go through the legislature on something like this? And does that make sense? I'm just kind of curious how this is working.
Sure.
Maybe it's been done before, but I just think that it's certainly a money thing, and we might, I think we're going to hear from Senator Betzel, who I imagine has some concerns too. Does that question make sense to you?
Sure. Yeah, Mr. Chair and committee members, you know, there's a lot of program activities that go on that do incur expenses. As an example, we might decide, well, for all diabetics, we'd like to give them free access to drugs, to test scripts, give them waive all their co-pays so that they'll go in and see their doctor in hopes that will save money on the back end by keeping these folks healthier out of the emergency room and out of dealing with more long-term, more chronic conditions. So we're constantly analyzing and implementing various pilot programs. That's really where these sorts of programs fall in. And so there are some things that we bargain directly with the union members. Health assessments would be an example. It was something that both sides were very interested in. We brought that to the bargaining table, and we negotiated, and it's actually in the contracts. Other programs like medical therapy management, disease management, various health promotion programs, we certainly bring those ideas to the unions. Some of those fall under pilot language like we have here, where it's a little bit more experimental. We're not quite sure what to expect from the outcomes. There's things that we want to try, and if they really prove themselves, then they will likely then become an actual bargain aspect of the contract, where we would build it in specifically into plan design, make sure that it really that it's something that can occur ongoing. So with something like medical therapy management, where we offer the free drugs and free supplies, that was an 18-month program that we rolled out to our members. We work with the unions and give them continual updates on how those programs are performing. And really what we know up front is that there is going to be a cost, just like there is an upfront cost on some of these initiatives. We know with the EHRA that there's going to be an upfront cost to fund that. We know with the debit card that there's going to be an upfront cost to the program to provide those. But what we're not sure is what is the outcome on the back end going to be. As it relates to the FSA, if we can increase FSA elections by approximately 14%, we will actually have paid for the debit cards, and it may be a cost-neutral initiative. When it comes to the health reimbursement account, if we get certain behavior changes out of our members as a result of this, we will actually see less cost down the road from the program. So I think areas where we know that...
I'm not objecting to probably what you're doing. It's the more or less the process is what bothers me a little bit. So with that, Senator Betzel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Morocco, I think the governor announced some of these initiatives about a month or so ago, so I've known generally about what was out there. I don't know the details, and we may not know until we actually have some formal proposals before the legislature. Some of them are going to take some legislative time. For instance, I've been involved with data practices issues all the years I've been here, and I've worked on electronic records, healthcare issues, and so forth. And those issues are not going to be easily resolved. There's going to be some, because there tends to be some controversy to them as to who gets access to them, who's going to have the oversight of them, how they're going to be secured. So, and I'm sure the legislative committees in both bodies are going to be spending a certain amount of time trying to get a better understanding of what the proposals are, and we're certainly not going to get there today. As to the surplus issues, I think that's something that we need to spend some time on in the committees and possibly even here on. I'm glad that there's a surplus, over what your reserves expected. What we don't want to see is, I think, what happened, I believe, in 2003, when about $25 million was taken out to balance the budget. And I think we paid about a $5 million penalty to do that. We don't want to see the surpluses used for that purpose. They should be used for healthcare purposes. However, when we went through the budget negotiations in 2007, and we were trying to balance the budget, and we had some difficult choices to make, we wanted to find some way to give employees a pay raise. And we were also told at the same time that the agencies were having these skyrocketing health care costs. So we couldn't even call the 3.5% that was banded around the Senate a pay raise, because it was a salary supplement, because the employees may not even get the money. it was all probably all going to go to pay health care expenses. And we ultimately settled on 3%. We've seen the contracts coming in at 3.25%, and which I think is good. But again, the expectation was is that maybe there was going to be a minimal pay raise because of all these health care costs. Again, we're glad that you know we overshot the mark, and there's actually been additional money. But in hindsight, I don't know that that's where the legislature would have gone if we would have known what the actual health care costs were going to be. We might have put them somewhere else to actually lower health care costs or greater salary supplements or something else. And so I think that you know what the chair's question was that you know now that there's a surplus, would that have been the direction the legislature would have gone in how to do it, or you know is that the best way to have applied the funds for in setting up these reimbursement accounts? I don't know what the answer is because that wasn't the question that was presented to us. But I think we may have questions, you know, down the road when the agencies come in and saying, well, we need more money to cover health care costs and say, well, yeah, but, you know, you told us last time it was going to be 10%, it was 3%, and what are you going to do with the money if we appropriate it, you know, at the mark that you want it at, and now you're going to do something different than what we had anticipated? I think those are the questions that we are going to have. We're happy there's a surplus, but I don't know that this is where we would have gone had we known, you know, that, and we couldn't foresee the future any more than you could. But who made the decision then that say, okay, we've got the surplus, let's set up these accounts? Because is that the best or wisest way to do it? I don't know.
Sure. Mr. Barker. Chair and Senator Betzold, really the process, I think you raise a great point. The process that we have as a program is when we become aware of these, you know, we certainly let our commissioner and others know, and probably most importantly is the unions. And so really that's the point at which we enter discussions about what should we be doing, how confident do we feel about the numbers. You know, the challenge is that when we're looking at healthcare trends, and most of this is established during the bargaining process, we're really looking at information that's about a year old, trying to project what's going to happen 2 to 3 years out. We start the bargaining process in January, but we're really bargaining, you know, two to three years out. So when you think about what's going on with medical trends, where they fluctuate anywhere between 8% and 18% on any given year, it's that kind of volatility that does make it tricky, which is why we do review the account on a quarterly basis because of that volatility. The information that we have at the time that people come and ask us about the program, where the reserve's at, it's all based on what we know as of that day. But again, with the volatility and the kinds of increases that can occur in the medical arena, that is the challenge that we have. So we'd be happy to, and we do, in fact, I'm working with Helen Roberts and Kevin Lundeen now talking about where the CGIP reserves today, how does what we're discussing today affect that, and where do we see things going in the next year. We will certainly do that as Paul Larson begins his bargaining process this January. We will have those exact same discussions with the unions.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Betzold.
And let me point out that as recently as the 08 session, when we were trying to balance the budget with a close to $1 billion deficit, and we were locked into some proposals. The governor had some proposals to cut the health care access fund. That wasn't where the legislature was. But some of the proposals, at least that came out of the Senate, was to, well, maybe we should, you know, try to cut agency budgets, you know, to try to make up the difference in order to protect the health care access fund. And I was on not only the Senate Finance Committee, but the conference committee that, you know, tried to look at the ultimate balancing, and the agencies were just livid. They were saying, you know, we're down to the bone, you know, you just can't cut us anymore, we can't do anything because, you know, we just can't absorb these cuts that you're proposing. And again, it had, putting in light of the previous year's setting of the budget, when the agencies said they needed more money to cover health care costs, you know, I think if we would have had a better handle on the fact that CGIP was going to have this kind of a surplus, you know, one of the options we could have looked at was, well, maybe we could, you know, help the agencies out by, you know, sending some of the money back that, you know, we appropriated for some of the their health care costs. Maybe that could have helped balance the budget, you know, in the end. And maybe we didn't have that information back then. But as I say, to now step forward and say, well, let's set up these reimbursement accounts might be the right idea, but going through some of the problems we had the last two budget cycles and hearing what the agencies were saying as far as their situation was, I don't know where the legislature would have come down on that. And as I say, this was just last spring that we were having these problems. So
we certainly have some concerns on how this is playing out, but I don't know if we have any action, no action to be taken, yeah. But
Mr. Chairman,
this is kind of an ongoing thing, and we have some concerns, and as you can, I don't know if, Mr. Morocco, if you've gotten that letter from the majority leader to Mr. Hansen, I'm sure you'll be. So he has concerns, too. Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder, and all of the information that I'm looking at and reading, I'm wondering, what role does the legislature have, if any, at this point in this discussion, or is this just a plan that will go to the bargaining table?
That's kind of what
sure
I was. You asked the question better than I did. That's what I was kind of getting at.
Okay.
The process and what don't we have to do anything as a legislative branch? Or give us a short answer.
Sure. And, Mr. Chair, most of these program decisions can be made and typically have historically been made just between the unions and the program.
Okay. Well, maybe this has been okay. Representative Bigham.
I don't have any questions about this, but I wanted to ask some questions on the memo from the last meeting that you wrote up, following up on the last Subcommittee on Employee Relations. For the sake of time and brevity, last time we had talked about kind of the inconvenience that some state employees have had on the drug program, Navitus. And my question deals with number 5 on the little memo about more user-friendly process. And you talk about how Navitus has agreed with the department to implement an appeals process. My question is, how long does it take? And I'll leave it at how long does it take, and then I may have a follow-up.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Bigham, It can be as quick as 48 hours, or it could take up to a couple weeks, depending on the individual circumstances of the member.
And, Mr. Chair, Mr. Morocco, do you think that's acceptable if somebody is waiting on a prescription drug that they need to, for whatever reason, for an illness or for comfort or whatever?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bigham, as indicated in the second, in the sixth question or response, really my recommendation for someone in that position would be to simply purchase the drug and then allow the process to still occur. And if there were expenses that were inappropriately charged to the member, then that would be refunded back to them. And that's something that even outside of the appeals process can always happen. If something happens where you overcharge, you can simply contact Navitus and you will be reimbursed. But again, really going through the primarily the four options, the first would be to have the pharmacist contact the prescriber. Is there something different that can be done here? And the pharmacist will be reimbursed for the time to do that, so it's not at their own expense. Obviously, the member has the option to call the prescriber and say, is there something that can be done here? These options work very well when it's 8 to 5, Monday through Friday, providers and physicians are in the office and have the ability to respond. But obviously, during holidays and late at night, those don't become as good of an option. So certainly in a situation where a member can wait a day or two to simply then contact the provider at a time when they would be available the next day or the next working day, I think would then be the next probably best option. And then ultimately, if all of those fail, it would be to simply pay for the drug and then come back to Navitus through the appeals process and then have the appropriate copay adjusted for the member.
You know, I don't, Mr. Chair, I don't I guess I don't mean to, I guess in the ways, go after the messenger here. So basically, nothing is going to change regarding this program. People are still, if they have issues with their pharmacy, are still going to have to possibly wait and be delayed, to get a prescription, and still have to go through some rigmarole to get what they need regarding their prescription drugs. Because that's pretty much what I'm hearing from this memo is that, yeah, this is actually the process laid out. This is what we're recommending, and it hasn't changed since last meeting. And if that's the case, I really would highly recommend then surveying the members in some sort of cost-effective way to do so, to see if this is a program that people still want to continue on. Because I don't think inconvenience people, when you're dealing with prescription drugs, whether it's for mental illness, for diabetes, for any of the, for any sort of illness that people are going to have to be delayed for and have to get put through the ringer on, is acceptable for any pharmaceutical or prescription drug program. And I feel that with this program, we're hitting our head against a wall. And I don't think that's the best way to serve, the members that are having to be in this program. So.
Okay, any...
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. Although it's an interesting issue about the Navitus and the drug thing, I'm actually now concerned because I was taking a generic and Navitus won't pay for the generic. They'll only pay for the more expensive drug, and it seems crazy. I took the generic for years and did fine. And so that seems a little wacky to me, but, I didn't know what I could do about that. That's a kind of a problem in reverse, I guess, what a lot of people have. But my question, I'm kind of bouncing back to the proposal for the FSAs and the HRAs, and I'm wondering if I'm one of those people that's had done the FSA and then I don't and then I do. And, right now I'm not. But even if you don't have an FSA, would you be part of the HRA thing? And then my question is, if you pay up to $250 of my copay, for example, in a year, now I'm not paying that copay, so am I apt to use it more than I would? I mean, the reason for the increase in copay, I thought, was to kind of get us to be more careful about when we ran in to the doctor. But if you give me $250, well, gosh, that's at least 10 visits or something right now. So can you comment on that, which seems to be kind of intuitively the reverse of what we wanted to do?
Sure. Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator. That's really what we want to find out is what kind of impact does this have on members' behavior? Does it do as you described, or will it be allow members to become more aware of just what things cost in general? We're not really sure. Again, if somebody is avoiding taking a prescription drug because they can't afford it, and I'll tell you that actually I did receive a call this morning, and I was told that somebody's donating blood so that they can afford medical expenses. These are very serious situations. So if in that case, if you are avoiding care, if you're avoiding going to get your checkup because you can't afford it and you have this $250, what is that going to do for you? So that's really, maybe that will all be a wash in the end. We just don't know, but that's part of what we want to find out. And there is a lot of discussion in the marketplace about, consumer-driven health plans, high deductible health plans, and the impact that it's having. And there really is a lot of mixed reviews and reports on the effectiveness of those kinds of programs. We feel that this is a good opportunity for us to try and venture into that and just see what kind of impact mm-hmm. that has.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Bigham.
I thought that's what the health assessments were for, but never mind. That's just kind of a poke at them again.
Okay.
Yeah. I guess I put some money in what they call a flex plan that works.
Precisely.
That's the FSA.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's different than the H. Okay, I got it.
right. Are we done?
Thank you.
Tui gets a kick out of these. Such a do it. Okay. I think thanks for all the cooperation of our members here and the good questions. And we're probably through with all of the contractual agencies. So till we meet again, Mr. Lenny.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Lenny.
For the record, I haven't actually seen his letter, but I understand Representative De La Forest did resign effective Monday of this week.
Oh, from the legislature.
From the legislature.
Oh, really? Okay.
And so maybe Mr. Hubinger should double check. I haven't seen the letter, but I understood that was his intent to do that.
Yeah, and we've got to. I got to talk to Senator Senjum and Senator Pogemiller about replacing
Senator
Wergen.
Does that mean I have to talk to the Speaker about
Put
it on my list of things to do, Mr.
Because it's not always easy to get a quorum and people get things going, so we need a full contingency of 10 members. So thanks for the update on Mr. De La Forest. Okay, with that, the meeting's adjourned.
I had a most... Talk to him,